Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. If I may begin with my usual reminder about memberships, I understand tonight that we have a judge of the Court of Appeal and a professor who was selling memberships. So this was an opportunity to buy memberships that had been touched by high judicial and professorial hands. I've given up trying to sell you memberships for this year, but haven't given up trying to sell you for next year now. There's no end to this, and we're already planning the program, of course, and beginning to worry about how we'll meet ends next year. And you know, I think, from previous comments, that we are now saying that if you buy a membership tonight or next week, it will count for your membership for the next year. So in fact, we are selling memberships for next year. I'd point that out to you. Our speaker this evening is Professor George Towers, who's one of UBC's most distinguished scientists. His background is of some interest. He was born in Bombay, India, but that was apparently on his way to Burma. And he grew up there, went to school in Burma, and then during World War II was in the British Navy. After that, he applied for a fellowship, a scholarship, to McGill. And he says, to his surprise, he won it. He went to McGill, and there he did brilliantly as a student, took his first degree in the master's, and then he went on for his doctorate to Cornell University. And even before he got his PhD conferred, McGill had induced him to come back and had made him an associate professor at that institution. He remained at McGill until 1962. He then went off to the National Research Council as a senior research officer. I think it was stationed in Halifax, one of their institutions. And then in 1964, UBC was able to persuade him to come here as the head of the Department of Biology and Botany. He remained in that position until 1971, and then gave that up so he could concentrate on his scientific work. He continued as a professor here, where he still is. And in the meantime, of course, he has succeeded in establishing an international reputation for his work. He's published over 200 papers. His research is on the field of plant biochemistry, especially the photochemistry of special compounds extracted from plants. And this is the foundation for his talk tonight. He is in great demand all over the world as a speaker, and we have been very fortunate indeed to persuade him to come this evening to talk to us on medical botany. Professor Towers.
Thank you very much, Professor Bowen. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm delighted to be here this evening to speak to you. I haven't spoken to a group of civilians before. I usually address students or colleagues in other universities. So I really am very pleased to be able to say something about some of the work that has gone on in my laboratory and in some of the work which has gone on in collaboration with many other people, both at this university and other universities in the world. I'd like to thank a few people over here whom I see in the audience, with whom I've been associated, particularly my research associate, Dr. Watt, Dr. Cheekett Watt, but also Dr. Levy, Dr. Hudson of medical microbiology, and many, many other people. I can't remember their names right now, and I won't bore you with giving you these names, but I will get on with what I'm supposed to talk about. Actually, the title of my talk, as suggested, is Medical Botany and the Environmental Challenge, a really awkward hybrid, and perhaps something like Zen Buddhism and the art of motorcycle maintenance. Very difficult to put these two things together. And I will try. I will say something about medical botany, and at the end I will say a few words about my philosophy regarding the environment with respect to plants, and my ideas on the subject improve with each glass of beer. So I can't drink whilst I'm talking, so I'm afraid it'll be very boring. However, the first part of my talk is on medical botany. I have lots of slides, and I'll go through many of them rapidly. Some of them I will hold for a bit longer. I was warned I have to wait for a few minutes for this thing to come on. Am I doing this wrong? Everybody thinks he or she knows something about medical botany. A lot of people are interested. Vancouver is a great city. People over here are really interested in plants, and they grow a lot of plants, a lot of poisonous plants, I might add, in their backyards or in their gardens. But a lot of people are fascinated with the use of plants in medicine.
Where's the slide?
Yes. Thank you.
Everything's lit up. Yes. Nothing's on the screen.
Well, anyway, the slides will come, and there are a lot of them. So there are a lot of people interested in medical botany, and this must go back way, way back in the evolution of man when he first had to explore plants as sources of food. There are many, many toxic plants, as you know. Plants have no means of defense, or very few means of defense, other than the elaboration of very, very toxic chemicals, which are directed against predators of one sort or another, herbivorous animals, ranging from insects, or even below that level, fungi and bacteria, and so on. Oh, sorry. I didn't even touch the slides then. I went off.
The lights are on, right?
Hmm? Good grief. Yeah. Hmm? And let's get hold of this fellow and see what the matter is. Yeah. Thank you. Am I doing something wrong? Just keep forward. Thank you. These are some Venezuelans practicing medicine. This is snuff, a plant snuff. These are Ecuadorians selling plants, medicinal plants, in a bazaar in Ecuador. This is a man preparing a chemical, also in South America. The South American peoples, the native peoples, are very interested in medical botany and still study it, and a lot of this information is being lost rather rapidly, and it can be quite disastrous in another 50 years, because it has taken millions, or not millions, it has taken thousands of years to accumulate this information about the useful plants and toxic plants. If you like home remedies, you can buy this for $15 in Vancouver. If you have a friend who has cancer, you might like to try it on him. This is from a plant, a Brazilian plant. This is a $1 million industry in Brazil. I have no idea whether it's efficacious or not. But this can be purchased over here. There are lots of remedies like this, and It's a reflection of the fact, in a way, that most plants have not been examined chemically, and it is the chemistry of the plants which in the end is responsible for their biological activities. So if we don't understand the chemistry of the plant, then we can't really say very much about it. But many plants, thousands of plants have been examined for their biological activities or their medical activities, but very few, perhaps 1 to 5% have been examined for their chemistry. Here's a plant, for example, which is, most people wouldn't be aware of the fact that this is a medicinal plant. This is podophyllum, which grows in eastern North America. If you are unfortunate enough to have venereal warts, this plant has a chemical in it which is very useful for the treatment of this type of viral problem. This plant is Cephalus ipecacuanha. It's a very old remedy and used today over here. If one is unfortunate enough, for example, to swallow a bottle of aspirin and you rush to hospital, they'll give you a shot of this stuff, which is a chemical extracted from the rhizomes of this South American plant, which has been used for thousands of years as an emetic. And there are millions of cases like this around the globe. In some cases, in some instances, the use of these plants was well documented. It's only recently, however, that plants, for example, of Central America have been documented here, for example, by Julia Morton. And this is a very useful volume. This also is a relatively recent addition to the medical botany literature. Don't ask me what these botanists are doing, but I think they're inspecting a plant over here, or a tree. But these are relatively recent. If you want to really read about medical botany in ancient times, you have to really go to the Chinese literature, because there's a great tradition of medical botany in the People's Republic of China. And here, for example, we see that they have approximately 4,000 flowering plants which are used in medicine. There are, roughly speaking, something of the order of 250,000 flowering plants on this planet. And they have found 4,000 of these to be useful in medicine. Now, in the Western world, of course, there aren't that many which are being used, but there are still a lot, and there are probably many, many more which can be used. But we have to discover what is the basis of the chemistry and the usefulness of these plants. And in most instances, we are not doing anything about it. We can go back. Here is another medicinal plant, the foxglove, which is very common in Vancouver, digitalis, which is a million-dollar industry. There are a lot of people taking digitalis. The plant is here. This is from a very old herbal. This is a slides borrowed from the UBC library through Professor Norris. This is Digitalis purpurea, I believe, or it could be another species, but this is a source of Digitalis. We can go back now. In the old days, of course, the doctors had to know botany, because this whole subject grew up together, really, medicine and botany. And here we see a very ancient manuscript of a doctor holding up a urine sample. There's a man with some sort of box, and there's a plant in the center there. This is about in the 5th century, a drawing of the 5th century, but it shows you that the medical person understood botany and understood plants. Here is a herbal which fitted into a saddle bag, apparently, carried around by the doctor to identify plants. The medical people really knew some botany at that time, and the botanist, of course, also had to know some medicine. These are from the Codex Mexico, pre-Cortes, drawings of plants. That is a member of the sunflower family, I believe, a member of the Compositae, rather beautiful drawings. These slides are also from the UBC library. And here is a botanist. And you might see, if every time you see photographs of botanists, they always look miserable. And I don't know why, they have to look like this. But this is an ancient botanist, and he also is holding up a urine sample. There are the plants over there, but he obviously is practicing medicine as well. These are some more very, very old slides. This is a plant that was used as an analgesic, the mandrake, and there was a superstition about it that when you pulled out this part of the plant, that it let out a scream, so you shut off your ears, and then you tie this up to a dog, and you send the dog running off, and it yanked the plant out of the ground, and then you had your cure for whatever it was. I'll show you the slides now. There will be some slides with chemistry on them, and I apologize for them because I know a lot of people don't. I know my students can't stand this. A lot of people over here, I'm sure, can't stand it either. This is taken from a Chinese review article, but it just shows you this is an anti-worm treatment in various parts of the world: Europe, East Asia, South Asia, East Africa. Totally different species of plants. That's a fern, and those are flowering plants. But in each instance, the chemistry is very similar. People on different continents, in different parts of the world, have found plants which are useful in the treatment of worms, anthelmintics. And when they are examined chemically, we find that there's a similar chemistry, which makes me say something about chemists also. See, the chemists got into this act, and I think in a sense, they are responsible for this splitting away from an interest on the part of botanists in medicine and on the part of medical people in botany. Because the medical people now could rely on chemists and the whole pharmaceutical industry to provide them with pure chemicals to do their studies, and so there was not necessary for a medical man anymore to be able to distinguish between plants, except in some instances where, for example, in allergies and so on, where I'll say something in a few moments. Here, for example, is where the chemist got into the picture. This is the treatment of a fish poisoning, ciguatera poisoning, and the people of New Caledonia used this plant, Dubuisia mycoporoides, which contains nicotine, which is an extremely toxic chemical, and scopolamine. The chemist has improvised these and prepared an oxime of this aldehyde and atropine, and the combination of these is used against this poisoning. It's very similar, and I think it illustrates the usefulness of chemistry also in this whole area of medical botany. I got interested in this whole subject rather accidentally through John Mitchell, who is a professor of dermatology at UBC, who also has a practice at Shaughnessy Hospital. And he's written a book. He's become a botanist. And he's a very good botanist. He's a very good dermatologist also. But he came to my office many years ago and told me that he brought in this plant, this lichen, which he called a moss. I had to correct him because as a botanist, I knew it was a lichen. He said, I have a patient who's allergic to this moss. Could you give me a name for it? So I said, well, that's a lichen, and there are literally millions of tons of this lichen growing in Canada. It contains some interesting chemicals. My students, as class exercise, isolate an antibiotic from it, but it's lichen. I gave them the name of it, and I said, incidentally, you might be interested to test the chemical from this lichen on your patient, which he did, and sure enough, it was that specific chemical that his patient was allergic to. And so he went away and wrote 2-3 scientific papers and became quite famous for his discovery of this. I bumped into him a little while later, and I said, you know, I suppose I was very arrogant and rude. I said, you know, there are right-handed molecules and left-handed molecules. Well, there are some lichens which contain the left-handed types, and there are others that contain the right-handed types. I happen to have the other isomer. Would you like to test that? Which he did, and his patient wasn't allergic to it at all. So he wrote another 4 or 5 papers on this topic and became even more famous for having discovered a stereospecific allergy to plant. Well, he came back a few months later and he said, I've got a plant over here, and this, I think I've got it on the slide, the next slide. He brought this plant here, which is an epiphyte on trees, on a birch, I think. This is a liverwort called Frelania. And he was really sharp. I hope he's not here tonight. But he discovered he had the name of this plant already when he came to see me. He said, "Tell me, what is the chemical in this plant to which my patient is allergic?" I said, "I can't tell you, but for $25,000, I can hire a good chemist to come and work in my laboratory, and we'll tell you what the chemical or chemicals are in this." And we did, as a matter of fact. And from that time onwards, we've collaborated for, I suppose this is 15 or 20 years ago when I first came to UBC, and he got me terribly interested in medical botany. Well, he's a very modest and retiring chap, so I'm sure he's not here tonight. And what we're talking about here is a skin allergy. Everybody in Canada knows about skin allergies, really. But let me just say one or two very simple words about it. It's sometimes it's cryptic. You go out in a field of nice-looking plants, and I've been out with botanists and sat in a field of poison ivy for a picnic, and then nothing happens for 24 hours. Then the problem starts. You get blisters, erythema, weeping of sores, and so on, and it's really very, very unpleasant. But there's a delayed reaction. It takes between 1 and 2 days before the symptoms show up, and often the person, the who has this problem does not associate it with the source, with the sensitizing agent, with the allergen. Poison ivy is a very good example of this type of allergy here. This is a lady who worked for 17 years as a florist and didn't realize that she was allergic to chrysanthemums. And there are a lot of people who handle plants of this sort and are not aware of the fact that they have this allergy, this type of allergy. Allergic contact dermatitis, it's called. Well, we started to publish papers in this area of allergenic substances in the sunflower family of plants, or the compositae, which represents about 10% of flowering plants, and many people are allergic to these plants and do not realize it. We became very interested in this, and people from other parts of the world kept writing and saying, "Well, we have a case of allergy to the sun, some member of the sunflower family. Do you know, could it be this type of chemical that is involved?" Well, here, for example, is a type of a test. This is not done in my laboratory, but at the University of California. This is the usual type of, this is an unusual type of patch testing, I might tell you, because there's an overdose been provided to this unfortunate student here. This is a plant, Phacelia minor. There are many species of Phacelia in British Columbia, but people become sensitized to this type of plant. We met this gentleman who's a dermatologist from Pune in India, and he said, "Well, you people are interested in allergies to compositae." He said, "This plant here," this is taken somewhere outside of Bombay, Dr. Arvind Longkar of Pune, he said, "I have in the last year 500 new patients who are allergic to this plant." He said, "I had it identified by the Botanical Survey of India as Parthenium hysterophorus. It's a member of a compositae, and it's an American weed. It grows in the southern United States, the Caribbean, through Mexico, Central America, all the way down to Argentina. And it got into India in a shipment of grain about 30 years ago. It's a particularly aggressive plant. It's not a very attractive one. I've got a sample over here. I see Dr. Gordon Shrum thought it might be a sample of marijuana that I've brought in. But this is the plant Parthenium hysterophorus. These are the flowering heads, a close-up of it. An inconspicuous-looking plant, but a very, very aggressive one. And Dr. Mitchell and I went to India to see just what was the extent of the growth of this plant in Pune. We got young people here. I was going to work on the chemistry of it. We got young people to collect the plant. Young people are not sensitized. It's only adults who are sensitized, so it was quite okay for them to handle the plant and to collect various parts of it and samples for us. But you can see how it grows here. Oh, here it's rather a large plant, and it grows in every nook and cranny and every vacant lot in this city. This is Dr. Longkar's daughter, Rohini Longkar, who helped me collect samples. It is not only a medical hazard in India, but it also is an agricultural one. Here a buffalo, for example, grazing on Parthenium hysterophorus. You can see that the whole field here is literally one plant, one species. It loves India, this plant. It loves many parts of the tropics, but it loves India, and in fact it has spread to every state in India now. But it is growing here. These buffaloes will eat this plant, and their milk will be bitter and cause problems also there. So it is a hazardous plant in every way, and there's no way of eradicating it. The mayor of Pune got, I think, 20,000 school children to try to uproot the plant, but it was an absolutely hopeless task because this plant flowers four times a year in Pune, and it grows everywhere, and there's no method of eradicating it. This is a symptom, one of the symptoms of this allergy. I spent a whole week at Dr. Longkar's clinic. Here you see this sort of rash on the forehead. If you've had poison ivy dermatitis, you know what I'm talking about. These people don't know what is the cause of their problems. Here's a policeman who'd never ever seen the plant, he claimed. He didn't even know what it was like, but he's got a really bad, a very severe case. And there's a lady with this problem also. And when I went to India, I went to southern India as well, to a very prestigious institute down there, and I said, in Bangalore, and I said, I just noticed as I was coming up here on a bus that you've got this plant growing down here, are you not worried? And the Dean of Agriculture there said, oh, we're not worried, we'll just spray these plants and get rid of them and so on. Well, two or three years later, I see this in a newspaper clipping about Bangalore. It says, Mr. Shivana, Home Guard Commandant, has been fighting a losing battle. Well, he certainly has been fighting a losing battle, because this plant, as I say, is in every state of India. And it is a real, really serious problem, I think, a serious medical problem. The people there are not, really don't understand. This man is drying his blanket on a bush of Parthenium. There's a chap who's sort of living in the bushes over here. It's a rather dangerous practice, but you see people doing this everywhere because there are no public toilets in many places. And here's a map showing you the distribution of this weed now. This is its home. It is native to the Caribbean, Central America, Mexico, Texas. You'll find it in the streetcar tracks of New Orleans. I went all around the southern U.S. and picked up this plant just to study its chemistry. Venezuela, Brazil, Argentina, Africa, India, China. And now it's got into Queensland, and they're extremely worried because it's a rampant weed in Queensland. In fact, I was invited there to give a talk about this allergy and so on. And I was delighted to tell them that they have to do something about it. But the Australians are really trying to do something special. They sent their biologist to Mexico to collect bugs, and there's a beetle here which destroys this plant rather well, and they are hoping to put this beetle, it's called Zygogramma, by Colorado. They're going to put this beetle in the field and hope for the best, that it attacks the Parthenium plant and doesn't go for crop plants or for other Australian plants. But this weed is growing very fiercely in Australia, in northern, northeastern Australia, and it could become very important in a number of years. Well, you see how what I'm saying tonight is very anecdotal, but this is the only way I can really talk about this problem, because it just sort of grew and grew and grew into something quite enormous. And it's just an example of how an understanding of the chemistry of the plant and an interest in the medical problems associated with plant can lead a botanist into totally new areas. The chemicals which are responsible for this allergy reside in little hairs on the plant. If you look at this little thing afterwards, this sample of Parthenium, you will see little hairs or trichomes on the surface of the stems and the leaves, and the chemicals are right in there, so that if an insect bites the plant, for example, it gets a shot of these insects. If you're a chemist, you might be interested that this is the active part of these molecules. It's called a methylene, an exocyclic methylene function in the molecule, and it's responsible. This is the main chemical in Parthenium hysterophilus. These chemicals, some of them are known to have anti-tumor activity, and so Dr. Julia Levy and Daphne Mew and some people in my lab, they investigated this and showed, in fact, that this compound has very good anti-tumor properties, although it is also extremely toxic to mice. And we hope sometime to be able to get on with this work and to show and to see whether it really is a useful chemical or not. There are many chemicals which have anti-tumor activity, but which are also extremely toxic. And this one is toxic in higher doses. However, with some chemical modifications, it might be possible to design a molecule which could be used in the treatment of cancers, for example. Now, here again is another illustration of a botanist. Notice the miserable look on his face. Well, I started off in botany. I can't find a cheerful picture, as a matter of fact, of a botanist. If there's anybody here who has one, I would be delighted to take it and make a slide out of it. I like to refer to this as high technology botany, a magnifying glass, a vasculum, and some sheets of paper in which he's going to press the plant, and he's deadly serious about what he's going to do. So I am a combination of a botanist and a biochemist. As you can see, my impression of biochemists is not very much better. I've combined these two and added a bit of sunlight to the picture, and I've become a photobiologist. Now, let me tell you something about this. This is a different topic again, but once more, it relates to the chemistry of plants. And it is as follows. There are many chemicals which are toxic, but they are only toxic in light. They are not poisonous. They don't have very much activity of any sort unless they are irradiated. Then the molecules in their excited state react with other molecules, and they become, in many instances, positively dangerous. And if they interact with cells, with living cells, they usually destroy the cells. This is a spectrum of sunlight as perceived on this planet. And the wavelengths of light that interest me particularly are between 320 and 400 nanometers. The near ultraviolet region of the spectrum, sometimes referred to nowadays as the UVA region. There's an appreciable component of this in sunlight, and this light activates chemicals which absorb light in this region of the spectrum. This is the visible range of light, and I'm not really very concerned with this. Now, there reside in plants many chemicals, in plants, in bacteria, in fungi, in animals, chemicals which, in their excited state, destroy cells. Here, for example, are two bacteria growing on a petri plate. This is Bacillus subtilis. It produces a chemical which interferes with the growth of this other bacterium, which is in the rest of the plate, which is E. coli. If we grow it in the dark, we see that there's an antibiotic there. But if we irradiate the sample, we see there's much greater antibiotic activity. The same thing applies to a chemical which has been applied to a piece of paper over here. You can see that it is very active in light here again. These chemicals I call phototoxic chemicals. It doesn't matter about the definition and all, but these are phototoxic chemicals, and they, in this instance, we see a sort of warfare between two different species of bacteria, one of which produces, excretes a chemical into the medium, which destroys the other. Now, there are many plants which contain this. The irradiation, the emission spectrum of the lights we use is there between 300 and 400 nanometers. We can take pieces of plant material and test them in this way. Here are pieces of plant material. This plate has been irradiated. This plate has been maintained in dark. And you can see there's a zone of clearing over here. When we use this pathogenic yeast, Candida albicans, we can see that it is destroyed by this by pieces of plant material of a very common plant. In this instance, this plant over here, which is a pan-tropical weed, Biden's alba, which we have studied a lot. My student Robert Norton and Jörg Marchant have studied this plant. And it contains in its leaves and in all of its parts, in fact, chemicals which have this biological activity. Here's another example of chemicals on pieces of paper. This is in light, this is in dark. And you can see we have a very good antibiotic which requires light for its activity. Dear me, I seem to have done something wrong here again. This is rather like those little machines in Las Vegas. Well, reverse, okay. It could be, all right, yes, thank you, yes. I'm sort of too close to everything over here. Let's try this. Oh, good Lord. Okay, some of these chemicals which are responsible for this type of activity, again, I apologize for showing you these structures, but I have to say a word about this particular one over here because it's a really interesting chemical. It's called 8-methoxysorolin. It's a flat molecule with three rings associated like this, and it has this piece sticking out of it, which is the methoxy part of this molecule. And this molecule, when it gets into the cell, it gets into the nucleus of the cell, it gets into the DNA of the cell, and it's sitting in here between two strands of DNA. There's one strand and there's another strand, and these are the bases, or this is part of these two strands of the DNA, the nucleic acid of the nucleus. This molecule has got in, and in a photochemical event, it reacts with one of the bases to form this adduct on one side of the molecule, or it can form an adduct with the other side of the molecule. This is a second molecule which is intercalated between these two strands, or it can form a bridge across the two strands. Now, this kind of damage occurs very often in your skin, for example, in sunlight, with short ultraviolet light, for example, and it is repaired many thousands of times. But this type of damage is a little more difficult to repair, and what the result is that one gets a damaged nucleus of the cell. And when the cell divides and two nuclei are formed, they are damaged, and so you disrupt the whole normal smooth process of cell division and cell multiplication. Here is, for example, what these chromosomes, the nucleic material of the cell, look like in a Chinese hamster ovary cell. This is a normal complement of chromosomes. And you can see there, these are all chromosomes, nicely paired up, and they look quite okay in the presence of 8-methoxysorolin, but in the absence of light. If we irradiate those cells, then we find that the chromosomes are damaged. This is genetic damage, very severe genetic damage. And it's extremely easy to demonstrate in the laboratory this type of thing. There are other types of genetic damage which are in evidence. For example, the formation of extra chromosomal genetic material, which you can see in these little blobs. They're called micronuclei. This also is evident. And so we know that this type of chemical is hazardous. I refer to it as a photogenotoxic chemical. It occurs in plants, in many plants, this type of chemical. For example, something else for a minute, but many, many plants contain this type of chemical. For example, members of the sun, of the umbelliferae, the parsley family, the fig family, ficus, and the moraceae, the citrus family. Every year you hear about people running into problems with citrus, limes, for example, and lemons in Florida. These plants contain these chemicals which cause chromosomal damage. And if you apply them to the skin, you get blistering of the skin if you go out in sunlight. But they have been used since ancient times, many of these plants, in therapy, in the treatment of skin problems, for example. Here's a very common skin problem. It affects about 5% of the world's population. It's an inability to form melanin in the skin. And in colored people, it's for cosmetic reasons. Obviously, one doesn't like to walk around with a spotted skin. Here's a person with a case of vitiligo. And here is the same person treated for vitiligo using that chemical, 8-methoxysorolin and light. You can see, very useful. There's still one or two patches where there's no melanization in the skin, but by and large, it's a very useful therapy, and not only that, you get a tan thrown in as well. This type of therapy is being used in thousands of places. If you have another problem, which is called psoriasis, this is a proliferation of skin cells. There are something like, again, 5% of the world's peoples have this problem. Here's a severe case of psoriasis. And here is the result of this treatment. What you do is to take 40, 50 milligrams of this chemical, stand in front of a battery of lights, of near ultraviolet radiation, and then you get cured. There's probably somebody in this audience who received this treatment here at Shaughnessy Hospital, for example. Well, one wonders about this, and I knew there had to be one side in backwards, because we had to shift them around when I came in here this evening. But this is quite interesting in some respects. This is taken from the World Health Organization recent bulletin of theirs, in which they have listed some of the most dangerous things that are going around in occupational hazards and medical hazards and so on. And it's interesting, we'll take my word for it, that this is mustard gas. I can read and write backwards. That's mustard gas. And this above it is PUVA therapy, which is 8-methoxysorolin, or the P and UVA. This is the therapy, and the United Nations now is sort of worried that this type of therapy is being used. Good Lord, I hope all these others aren't backwards too, because this is Ashwood Smith's name over here. He's a professor at the University of Victoria, and he pointed out to people that 5-methoxysorolin, which is a very closely related compound, and occurs in oil of bergamot. He said that should be taken off the market, because that is also a chemical which causes skin problems and causes genetic problems. And in fact, it has been removed. Oil of bergamot caused problems in women who used to dab perfume behind their ears, and then when they went out in sunlight, they wound up with big brown patches behind their ears, and their children accused them of not washing their ears. And it's caused by this type of chemical. But here's a little caterpillar. My wife showed this to me, actually, pointed out to me. Here's a little caterpillar of a very handsome species of butterfly, of Papilio, native to British Columbia, growing on a plant, which is a weed here, a species of Heraclium, which contains this type of chemical. And in fact, if you take that plant and you rub the juice of it on your skin and go out in sunlight, you'll wind up with rather unpleasant blisters. But that caterpillar has devised a method for dealing with it. It can eat this chemical, and it can change the molecule slightly so that it is no longer photoactive, and so it can live happily on it. But many insects can't live on these plants. Other insects have devised a technique, and I haven't got a slide of it, unfortunately, whereby they roll the leaf around themselves and avoid sunlight, and then they chomp away at the plant. Here are some other chemicals. I hope all the rest of these slides aren't on backwards, but it doesn't matter. I think we just look at them, because it doesn't matter to my class whether these molecules are upside around or not. Here are some alternatives which we think might be useful in the treatment of some of these diseases, but we do not have any money to do the kind of work that is necessary to find out how toxic these chemicals are. And this one, for example, appears to be much milder than 8-methoxysaurin, and we would like to test it and to find out whether it can be used or not. In the course of our studies along these lines, and I must tell you again, it was Dr. Mitchell who introduced me to this whole idea of looking at photoactive chemicals from plants, because dermatologists are very interested. Every year people go into their clinics with blisters on, and they wonder what happened, and they have to trace it back to a plant which they've handled in the field very often, and it causes this photodermatitis. It's an irritation, it's not an allergy, you understand? Well, we started to check out a few other plants. This is a member of the sunflower family, like these two over here. This is Desodia, taken in the Baja California desert. It's a beautiful little plant, and it's really a deadly plant also because it has these phototoxic chemicals in it. It's deadly in a sense to a beetle or a bug or a nematode or something like that, or a bacterium or a fungus. And if you take some of the juice of this plant and apply it to your skin, it also will cause lesions in the skin. But it's an example of the type of thing. This is another rather beautiful shot of another species in the Compositae growing in the Baja Desert. Last year was particularly beautiful because of the rains, and there were just carpets of these plants all over the place. Absolutely beautiful place to visit, unspoiled place at the moment. If you want a conservation, that's the thing. Well, it's that sort of a place anyway. We don't need that slide because we've got the plant here. This is my favorite plant, the marigolds, a common plant in the garden. And we've done a lot of work on the chemicals of marigolds, which belong to the same family, and they contain in their parts, particularly their roots, these very, very active phototoxic chemicals. Now, you can take a dilute solution of the chemical and you can apply it, for example, in this case, to a caterpillar. This tobacco hornworm, here's a control. This one has been treated with a small drop of the chemical, this one with a larger one. And you can just destroy these insects very readily with this chemical in light. You can use other organisms as test organisms. This is the life cycle, and that's a duck, okay? That's a man, and this is a snail. The duck produces myrosidia. It's parasitized by this organism. It's called Trichobilharzia cameroni. The organism enters the snail. It metamorphoses into another stage of its life cycle. It's excreted as this type of little torpedo or arrow-shaped organism. And this organism gets back into the duck, and so we have this cycle. It's one of the examples of parasites. This is an organism, for example, which occurs in Vancouver. And if you go into ditches on some of the lakes over here, you might intervene in this nice cycle, like this fellow over here, and get this organism getting into your legs. And then he sheds his tail. He dies because it's a hostile environment. And he sets up an allergic reaction, and you get swimmer's itch. Not a very important problem in North America, but a lot of lakes are not swimmable because of swimmer's itch. But this type of thing forms one of the major diseases of the world. Schistosomiasis or Bilharzia is a major disease of the world on the same basis as, to the same extent as malaria, for example. The parasite gets into the skin and then gets into the whole system, and you've had it. You can get treated now for about $3 a shot, but the next time you go down to the river to have a wash or to wash your legs, the snails there are excreting these cercariae, and they get into your system. Well, these chemicals are very useful against them. Here's one of these organisms here from a Vancouver snail, and if we zap it with light and the chemical, very low doses of the chemical, we destroy it quite readily, as you can see. And it's really dramatic to see how this chemical, this is a chemical from the common garden marigold, Tagetes. You can do more exotic experiments. This is with the red blood cell of Don McRae. I don't know if he's here tonight. He's a student who's expecting to get his PhD in a couple of days. This is one of his red blood cells, a normal one. And this is what one of them looked like after it was treated with this chemical and light. And you can see it appears as if there are holes punched in the membrane. In fact, we think that the target for this type of molecule is the cell membrane and not the cell nucleus. So here we have another type of phototoxic chemical. The first one, which is being used in hospitals, and thousands of people are receiving this treatment for psoriasis, for example. In that instance, the chemical attacks the cell nucleus. These chemicals appear to attack membranes. Red blood cells do not have, human red blood cells do not have a nucleus, and so there's no genetic material here to worry about. However, we know from other types of experiments, many other types of experiments, that they don't attack the nucleus. And you can see the difference in the mechanism of action of these two types of chemicals. This is the chemical from marigold. This is after 5 minutes or 10 minutes irradiation, just with natural sunlight, a 1% solution applied to the skin, and that will settle down to a brown or hyperpigmentation, which will last between 1 and 2 years on the skin. We tested this out on ourselves and on a number of dermatologists here, and that's what happens. This is the chemical which is being used in photochemotherapy, 8-methoxysorolin. There's no immediate reaction, but the next day, after 4 or 5 hours, it becomes very painful, and the next day you see the effects is very heavy blistering of the skin. And this is what happens when one comes in contact with these plants in the field. You find these are the chemicals, incidentally, from marigold. They contain sulfur, but many of them are acetylenic compounds. They have this acetylenic bond in them. We call them polyacetylenes. When we feed them to mosquito larvae, for example, the chemical, which is fluorescent, you can see it's gotten to all parts of the larva, the gills, the breathing tube, and so on. The blue fluorescence is caused by this compound. And it's absolutely wonderful demonstration. The mosquito larvae, you can see them swimming around in a solution of this chemical, very low dilution in the dark or in dim light, and then you irradiate them or take them out into Vancouver sunlight, and they're off, and within a minute they're dead. In fact, these chemicals, we think, are every bit as good as DDT. We've tested them out in comparison. We want to do field trials. We want to see whether these could be used, for example, in third world countries. These are biodegradable chemicals, and so on. Compound 13 is this one, and you can see the lethal concentration to kill 50% of these, or this concentration here, 0.01 micrograms per milliliter, and here is DDT, 0.07 micrograms per milliliter. These compounds are as good as DDT. All you need is light. The chemicals float to the surface, mosquito larvae come to the surface. When dawn breaks, they are destroyed. The chemicals are cheap to make. We've tried for 2 years now to get somebody interested in it, to give us some money so that it can be used, because the incidence of malaria, as you probably know, is back, for example, in India. It's back where it was 10 years ago because they're not using DDT in many parts of the world, like India, and it's a serious problem, and there are some chemicals which could be tested for this type of thing. But there's some resistance. I hate to say this, but there is some resistance on the part of agricultural people to the use of natural chemicals as pesticidal, as biocidal agents. I'm not saying that that's not why we got any money. We're not business people. That's our problem. There are other chemicals of this sort, phototoxic chemicals which attack membranes and which are useful or have great potential use. This one is not a useful chemical. This is a breakdown product of chlorophyll, which accumulates in cattle, for example, when they eat the wrong plant material. They get the equivalent of indigestion. This is an intermediate in the breakdown of chlorophyll. It accumulates in peripheral blood vessels. They go out in sunlight and they suffer from photodermatitis. And it's a very serious, a big
economic problem, agricultural problem in many parts of the world, the accumulation of porphyrins in animals. These porphyrins also accumulate in man under certain conditions of toxicity from chemicals. You've probably read about it, and there are also genetic diseases where intermediates in the synthesis of hemoglobin accumulate in the blood vessels, and people can't go out into sunlight because they accumulate this type of molecule, and they produce and it results in photodermatitis. Well, a number of years ago at Harvard Medical School, it was discovered that these compounds are very useful in the treatment of cancer. Compounds of this sort, in fact, they're being used widely now. Here, for example, is the type of chemical again. It's a very large molecule, a big ring there with four nitrogen atoms in it. It's called a porphyrin. And this is hematoporphyrin derivative, which turns out to be a complex mixture of porphyrins. And these porphyrins are used in the treatment of cancers. And the strategy is as follows. One is given a dose of the chemical, and the chemical diffuses through the body of the animal or the human, and it accumulates in tumors, and it takes longer to clear from tumors than it does from other parts of the body. Most of it is cleared from the rest of the system, but it is retained for a longer period in tumors. Why? Nobody is exactly sure. But you can now detect the tumors because these compounds are fluorescent, and so you can now irradiate the tumors and then destroy the chemical or destroy the cells, which are the tumor cells. It's a very elegant technique, which has, of course, a number of drawbacks to it, because you can't be sure that you've cleared the system, and people who undergo this form of photochemotherapy have to be very careful about avoiding light and so on, and there are sort of side reactions from this type of thing. But this chemical now sells for about $100 a bottle, and it's not even known exactly what the chemistry of it is, which is rather strange because, as you know, usually in order to clear a chemical and to be able to use it costs, say, at least $10 million these days. You can find a chemical which will cure anything, but to get it to pass the law, all the laws in the land and all that, there's so many tests that have to be done that it is a very expensive business. Anyway, this one, for some reason or another, I don't know what the reason is, we don't even know what the chemistry is, but it is being used in many hospitals in many places. If the tumor is internal, for example, if you have a bladder carcinoma or it's a cancer of the esophagus or some other part of your anatomy, one can introduce optical fibers into the system and then irradiate it through these optical fibers. It's very nice, and I've seen spectacular pictures of this sort of thing. I haven't been able to get any good pictures of this. I got a few, one or two slides, but they're not really very convincing, and it's hard to get convincing pictures of this, because this type of therapy, of course, is being used throughout North America and in other places. Here, for example, is somebody who's had recurrent cancer, and there is the location of it. This person is then given this chemical, and then this part is irradiated, the axilla is irradiated, and you can see there's just localized destruction of cells. And then this is supposed to be what it looks like afterwards, but it looks almost as bad as it was at the beginning, but believe me, it's supposed to have worked over here very well. Now, this type of therapy is very, very interesting. It's novel. A lot of people are using it. And we contributed to this also in an interesting way. Dr. Levy, if you don't know her, some of you have heard her talk over here a number of years ago. She's a very famous immunologist at UBC, a very famous immunologist. And she, her lab and my lab work together on trying to find a better way of doing this. She has, in fact, chemicals, antibodies for cancer cells. And so what we did was to take this type of molecule, these porphyrins, and tie them on to the antibodies, shoot these into mice, And then what happens is the antibodies go to the cancer cells, and then you irradiate the animal, and you get a very neat, a very elegant way of destroying tumors without the chemical, without using large doses of the chemical, and without the chemical having to proceed to other parts of the body where they may not, it may not be cleared very easily. And we're continuing these investigations. The work has been done by Dr. Daphne Mew, who's one of Julia Levy's students, and Dr. Chikit Watt, my research associate, and Dr. Levy, and I've also sat down in the back and chewed the fat with these people. But this work is very promising, and it's, again, it's another example of what can grow out of work, working with plants, working with light, and considering the application of these chemicals to medical problems. So I don't know what the time is, but I've sort of said, well, you know, I love to talk, but it's probably, well, it is slightly over an hour, but I just want to say a few words about the second half of what I was asked to say something about. This is a picture of a rather, on the right-hand side is a rather beautiful reserve in Ecuador, which I visited. Well, it must have been beautiful 10 years ago, before all the graduate students in American universities went down there trailing, looking for ant trails and looking at insects and looking at plants and all the rest of it. But it's a plot of land, say 5 miles by 5 miles, leased to an American university. And they don't cut down the trees, they don't destroy the forest. They've cleared everything around it for agricultural purposes because the people need food. But they've left that there. And so we can go down there for a nominal sum of money, and we can study the organisms in this thing. It's rather too small a piece of land in which to do this now. Everybody is alarmed about the fact that the forests of Brazil are disappearing, the forests of Colombia, the forests of Peru, Ecuador, Bolivia. People are just chopping down plants, clearing the land. China also. Their rainforests, they're destroying them, because they need land for food. And we sit back and say, gee, it's really terrible, you know, that they're doing all this, but we don't do anything at all about it. We are not sending people to study the organisms in that part of the world. I went all over South America. I met one group of Canadians, and they were in Peru studying potatoes. They weren't studying all these exotic plants that everybody claims that they're worried about losing, or the insects, or the fungi, or whatever it is. Nobody is doing any work, as far as I can see. We don't even have a formal course, as far as I know, in tropical botany. We certainly don't have one in medical botany. But there are chemicals in those plants. Most of those plants have never been examined. People use them. I've been to Africa. People are using the plants for medical reasons. Traditional medicine, which is largely medical botany, is very important and is being encouraged by the World Health Organization. These plants are being lost. The young people are not interested in getting chemicals from plants when they can go down to the local store and get a bottle of aspirin for a headache. Who's going to bother about going into the forest to seek out some plant or to learn how to distinguish between these plants? But there are older people who still know this, and the information is there. If we want it, we can get it. So if we're really concerned, we can go, we can make some arrangements so that they won't cut down areas, so that they can be studied. Plants can be collected. One doesn't have to grow these plants. We've got a magnificent botanical garden at this university. We don't have to grow all these plants in that botanical garden. We can grow, we can bring them back, we can put these things into tissue culture, for example. We can study the chemistry of these plants in tissue culture, although that also presents certain problems. The people down there are poor. I find it very expensive to send my students down there. My students, you understand, don't have expensive tastes, but it's very difficult to find money to send people down there to go and collect plants and all that. Two of my students, Don McCrae and Dennis McKenna, have been down there and collected it. The people are poor. They're absolutely beautiful. I just love the slides. I had to show it to you. These little children. I was on an American ship down there studying plants a number of years ago with Professor Schultes of Harvard, and we're on this air-conditioned ship, and we were really eating chocolate cake, and for breakfast we had frogs' legs and all the rest of it. And these people were going around our boat all day long in their canoes, and if we had a few sweets or chocolates, we'd throw them over the side. But it was really sad, you know, to see them. Now, mind you, they look very healthy. Well, there are a lot of people like this, and this, I think, they dress up. These are the Witoto of Colombia. They dress up for us. These people know about plants, but it is difficult to go down there. Not only is it expensive, but there are other problems associated with it as well. It's really tedious, you know. I mean, yeah, there are two botanists. Well, one of them is a botanist. The other guy's really lazy. He's out on the mule all the time. But we're collecting plants in Colombia. The terrain is awful sometimes. I'm not suggesting we had to climb up this waterfall, but it's like that in many places. The people are a bit dangerous. There's a drunken policeman with a rifle, which he'd love to use, I'm sure. That was at the police station. Accommodation is poor. There are rampant worms, as they say in China, in this place, and flesh-eating animals of one sort or another, so it's not very nice. And also one gets to a state of euphoria after a while in this hostile environment, and some of us never come back. Well, here's just the last shot of two of my students, Dennis and Don, who went down there to study some of the Amazonian plants. Dennis was interested in the hallucinogenic plants which are used down there and which are used in rituals, religious purposes and so on. And Don McRae was working on these plants which have antiviral activity, for example, and other sort of biological activities. I would love to send more students down to study these plants, and I know there are lots of people who would like to go. And we have to do this within the next 30 years, I would say. Otherwise, it may be far too late. Not only will the plants have gone, many of them, which will never have been identified chemically, but also the law about their usage will have gone. It's a really serious problem, and we do not consider it important in this country. I'm sad to say, right across the country, there's very little interest, there's marginal interest in the tropics, in tropical botany, and in places like this, or in Africa. I was in Africa 2 years ago, and I was in Central Africa in the southern Sudan, and you go to the marketplace there, there are hundreds of plant materials being used for medicinal purposes. We don't know what the plants are. We don't know anything about their chemistry. We don't know if they are useful. If the place develops, I don't know what will happen, whether all this information will also disappear. Anyway, on that rather sad note, I'd have to stop here. And I thank you very much for your attention. I hope it hasn't been too confusing. I'd be very happy to answer any questions if you care to ask me. Thank you. Thank you. Anything? Oh, yes, okay. All right, I don't need this too. Yes, please, certainly.
May we have questions now, please?
Yes.
Dr. Tarry, is there any medicinal quality, are there any medicinal qualities to any of our local vegetation?
Well, there's a slide that was missing over here. There's a local plant here, Heraclium, which grows in sort of swampy areas, which is the chemical from it is used in the treatment of psoriasis. But that chemical can also be synthesized chemically, but the same chemical is there. There are many, many plants which are used by native peoples over here, and the person who should be here tonight is Nancy Turner from Victoria, who has been studying the uses of the native plants. There are a number of them. I can't think of anything offhand which is really spectacular, but there are many plants used.
Are there people checking with the local Indians before
Yes.
The local
yes. Nancy Turner is doing this. Dr. Nancy Turner, who got her PhD in our botany department, she's studying the people, and she's publishing a number of manuscripts on the local, the different groups of people along the coastal Indian people, for example, and their uses of plants.
Question here.
Dandelions grow very annually all over the place, and there's white milk in the flower stem.
Yes.
Is there something told me once that it had some medical reason? You know what?
No. The gentleman asked me if the white milk from dandelions, what is it, and does it have any medical use? The white milk from dandelions is latex, and from which you can obtain rubber. In fact, the Russians were very interested in using dandelions as a source of natural rubber. It's very good rubber from dandelions, but rather small amounts, and you'd have to increase the yields, and you'd have to do a proper study of the species that you grow in your backyard here. But it is rubber. But dandelion seems to be a rather inoffensive plant, and I don't know of any medicinal uses over here. Yes? Oh, sorry.
There's a common plantain that grows just about as commonly as dandelion plant.
Yes.
Which I have heard also has some medicinal properties. Are you familiar with that?
No. Oh, this gentleman asked me about the common plantain, whether it has any medicinal uses or not. There are people here who could probably answer it from my laboratory, but I can't think offhand of anything useful from that plant. Yeah? Oh, sorry. I better get that person there.
Let's have this question here, then.
Has it been definitely established by the American and the PTECH Medical Association that Leotril and Apricot-Pitz is ineffective in cancer cure?
No, I can't really answer that question. I'm not a medical person, you understand. I'm a biologist. I'm an associate member of the Faculty of Medicine, but I haven't got any medical degrees. And I don't know what the story is over there. But I would say this. This gentleman has asked me about Leotril and whether the American Medical Association has cleared this material or not. I don't know. We isolate from plant material of that sort, chemicals which are on treatment with enzymes release hydrogen cyanide. They're very toxic chemicals. In fact, if you take most members of the rose family, whether it's peaches or prunes or cherries, you take the leaves and you grind them up, you grind a big bag of leaves, put your head in it, you release enough cyanide to give you a jolt and could be lethal if you're not careful. So hydrogen cyanide is a chemical which is produced, which is in with this, the rest of the material of this layer trial. So I don't know what else is there. But I would say, I think a lot of work from what I've read in the newspapers, there's been a lot of study of this, and I think that they've decided that it's of no use. But I'm glad somebody checked it. You know, you can't tell, but it's worth checking this. Yes?
Can you tell us about aloe vera? Does it really have any value?
I think so, yeah. There are a lot of people who think that it does. You know, it's something that occurs in many different parts of the world. And there must be a lot of people who believe. You know, I say people believe what they want to believe. I was in Texas some time ago, and I was looking at somebody's cactus garden, but something caught my eye over the fence, and it was an enormous field of aloe vera. They are producing it on a grand scale over there and selling it to somebody. And I was told the figures are, I don't know, so many million dollars, but they are putting it into all types of creams and cosmetic agents and so on. It is relatively harmless, and people think it does things for them. You ask the ladies and they will tell you, these things are wonderful for my skin and those things are terrible and all the rest of it. I mean, I've got to the stage where I sit down in a scented bath myself these days. Yes. Is it? That's right, that is. I think somebody in my lab checked out all of Bergamot. I think Dr. Watt checked Earl Grey's tea to see if it was phototoxic or not. And I think it isn't. So they've cleared this chemical out of oil of bergamot in Earl Grey tea. But it's good tea, isn't it? Yes, yeah. Yes?
Is there any studies on ginseng?
This gentleman asked me, have I done any studies on ginseng? No, I haven't done any studies on ginseng because you have to work very fast to catch up with the work that is going on in Japan, in phytochemistry, which is this area. These people are working on ginseng. They found another plant in Japan, which is not the ginseng plant, very easy to grow. I grew some in my backyard last summer. It's a member of the cucumber family, of the cucurbitaceae. It has higher levels of the ginseng chemicals in it than ginseng itself. And you can buy in Vancouver now a packet of this ginseng tea, not from ginseng, but from this other plant. The Japanese moved right in and they're selling it. So, you know, there's nothing much really there. But I used to think, well, ginseng, there's nothing in it, you know, but I think it has an effect on me. It makes my face red and it makes me feel a little bit more cheerful, but I don't know.
Question over here.
Yes.
Why is there the time delay? You started to mention it. The time delay.
Yes. There's a time delay because this is a reaction which involves cells and is a very complicated series of events which are not really understood even now. This whole subject is still in a state of flux, exactly what happens when the small molecule gets in. The molecule in itself cannot cause the allergy. It has to be hooked onto a protein, and it appears as if this protein must be associated with a specific type of cell, and these lymphocytes are involved in this process, and it takes some time to process the whole thing, so there's a delay in this reaction. It's quite a different type of allergy from the allergy which everybody is familiar with, the hay fever, rhinitis type of allergy. Yes?
Let's follow up on that, because once you get poison ivy, though,
yes,
and the blisters run, I'm an expert on this, I had 37 ties in my life.
Good heavens.
When the blisters run, though, there's not much delay on that, though. Once the stuff, the fluid flows over your skin, wherever it flows to, you'll get it right there.
Yes.
There's no two-day delay on that. There's a delay, but nothing like 2 days. There is a time delay on the incubation of the thing, but once you get it,
yes,
then it seems to spread.
But it may be that you're getting repeated contact with the chemical which is spreading over your skin. I don't know. I'll tell you a story, though, which I thought was amusing. At one stage, I wanted to do some work on poison ivy. My laboratory personnel didn't like the idea of working with poison ivy, but the morgue at Shaughnessy Hospital was going a-begging, so I thought at the time, and I thought that would be a great place, because in Canada, the defense group, whatever it's called, not the army, I think the army is very interested in finding some remedy for poison ivy. They lose more people in the field in the summer from poison ivy dermatitis than from anything else. So they would like to give people money to work on poison ivy. But it needs a special type of laboratory. But unfortunately, a bunch of engineers, can you imagine, a bunch of engineers got this morgue. I don't know what they've done with it. But we wanted to use it as a laboratory for studying this problem. But we never got around to it. So I can't tell you anything more about
question
it.
Here.
Yes?
I'm wondering if the Western European or American pharmaceutical industries are still looking at the plants as much as they were 30, 40 years ago. There were some companies that based their major profits on plant chemicals. And I haven't heard much about that in the last time.
Yes. This gentleman asks if there's still an interest by the pharmaceutical industry in developing chemicals, medical agents from plants. And the answer is, I believe it is, but they're proceeding a little more cautiously because it's so expensive to clear chemicals now. They also are somewhat skeptical because they produce a new chemical on the market and then somebody finds some objection to its use, and that's a lot of money invested in this whole process and it goes down the drain. They're still very, very interested. But many of the old remedies also are extremely important in this respect. People are trying to find novel ways now of producing these chemicals. Many of the important chemicals are very hard to synthesize chemically.
It can be done, and in most instances it has been done. But it's a very tedious, uneconomical process where you start off with a room full of crude chemical and you wind up, as you probably know, with a handful of chemical. It's a very difficult thing. So there are other strategies that are being employed. For example, in Germany now, digitalis is being produced in cell cultures. And the yields are much better than in plants. So they don't have to rely on the people in Tanzania or wherever it is being grown for this chemical, for digitalis compounds, which is also a multi-million dollar industry. They can get it from tissue cultures. This is a type of approach also being explored here in UBC, particularly by Dr. Kutney in chemistry, who's interested in some anti-leukemic chemicals from the common periwinkle, garden periwinkle, are very useful chemicals, but in very low concentrations in these plants, and so it would be very nice to get cell cultures to produce them. As bacteria produce special chemicals, so plant cells in culture can be induced to produce these chemicals. Sorry. No. This gentleman asks me if there's anything that has been done on the sugars of the tobacco plant. He's not interested in the nicotine of the tobacco plant. Well, the tobacco plant is one of the favorite plants of plant physiologists. It's easy to grow in the greenhouse and so on. A lot is known about it, and often one can get financial support for working with tobacco plants, so a lot is known about it. I don't think there's anything particularly interesting, at least I can't think of anything particularly strange about the tobacco plant with respect to its sugars. Most plants produce sucrose or cane sugar, that is the main sugar. Some families of plants, like the rose family, for example, produce other types of sugars, like sugar alcohols, for example, but by and large, in land plants, sucrose appears to be the sugar, and I don't think there's anything peculiar. Yeah? Yes. Oh. Yes. Oh, I see. I see. The gentleman asked me about, you're talking about the curing of tobacco and what happens to the sugars in the process there. Yes. Of course, Dr. Hans Steek, who's in the head of a cancer unit here in Vancouver, points out that one of the most potent mutagenic agents employed in the kitchen is caramelized sugar. That stuff you put on ice cream, for example, is one of the most potent mutagenic substances you can get anywhere. So whether it is carcinogenic or not, I don't know, but somebody, I'm sure, has shown that it is also carcinogenic in rats or something of this sort. Tobacco will have this material, but it's not ingested, and it's just smoked. Now, I realize that tobacco smoke is a very complex assortment of chemicals, unbelievable chemicals, which manage to get into this colloidal smoke, which diffuses around the place. Well, but I don't think caramelized sugar is one of the components of it.
It's a question at the back.
Yes. What examples can I think of allergenic substances from plants, flowers, and the same chemicals are used as cues, as chemical cues for insects? Yes? Something like that. I can't think of any allergenic chemicals. There are a lot of very pleasant chemicals. Of course, all perfume industry is based on this. And a lot of unpleasant chemicals produced by flowers, for example, which are cues, chemical cues for specific insects. But there are some of these coumarins, which are produced by plants which are phototoxic, and they may be important. I can't think. Honestly, I can't think. But that's an interesting point. Let me think about that.
A question here.
In Central Europe, from the farm and so on, people get certain infections on their hands. I know my father did it. He was a youth up in Bohemia. And doctors didn't do anything. And it happened to be cut head. And they cured it.
With using cabbage leaves.
Cabbage.
Yeah. Everybody's interested in medical botany, you see, and they all have anecdotes like that, and we don't know. This gentleman says his father used to cure his problem with using cabbage leaves, his skin problem, from handling produce of some sort or another. Now, what is it in it? I don't know. I have no idea.
Question?
Yeah. Children, when you had a nettle sting, you put a doctor.
Yes. Yes. This the gentleman here says that when you get a nettle sting, you can use a dock leaf and it alleviates the pain of the nettle. And this is in many countries they have this because, as you know, nettles, this family is distributed all over the world, and there are some terrible nettles in Asia, for example, which cause very serious problems. I don't think anybody ever studied this, because we still don't know the chemistry of that nettle sting, these little hypodermic syringes on the leaf. If you just brush your hand lightly over the leaf, these little syringes burst open, and the contents are under pressure, and they're injected into your system, and they cause an immediate painful reaction. We don't know the chemistry of it, because people aren't prepared to do the technology wasn't available. It's available now to do that kind of work, and it should be done, where you should take the hairs and examine the chemistry of the hairs. People in the past just take the whole leaf and grind it up with millions of other chemicals, and so they come out with some fancy story which nobody believes. We don't know what the chemistry of the nettle is to start off with.
This
Yes, it is still being used in the treatment of leukemia, and the price has gone up. And as I say, a lot of laboratories in the world are trying to grow tissue cultures of the plant called Catharanthus roseus from Madagascar. They're trying to grow this plant in tissue culture to produce this kind of chemical in large amounts. But so far, there has been no success whatsoever in this approach to getting more chemical. And the synthesis appears to be rather formidable at the moment, and nobody can make it synthetically. But it's a very useful chemical in leukemia, for example, the treatment of leukemia. This lady says that the fireweed, that's what you're talking about, the evening primrose, that the oil of it is being used in the treatment of arthritis and other ailments. Yes. That's right. Yes. Fatty acids. Right. Yes. And there's a great deal of interest. This is an exploding area of biochemistry, because there are a series of reactions involving that type of unsaturated fatty acid, and there are many different biological effects about which I know nothing, because I have not followed that particular thing, but I'm very interested in it as a possible problem. No. I'm sorry. Do I know anything about Dr. David Horobin? No. He's working on this, is he?
Yes, he's the man who's promoting
this. In Canada?
Yes, in Montreal.
I see.
He wants to go to the Dr. McLaren in England. He wants to go to the Dr. McLaren in England.
want to know about it, I can give you.
Yes, I would. Yes, I would.
Yeah. We have time only for two very short questions. One here. Yes.
Dr. Towers, you described the phototoxic chemical that was cheap and safe for use against mosquitoes and so on, and that we were having difficulty getting it used or getting it manufactured and used. What can we, the public, do to help get it underway?
Oh, I'd like to see you afterwards.
One question here, and then I'm afraid we have to stop.
Those weeds that we saw in India, why is it that children are not affected by it?
I don't really know that. Why are the children not affected by these weeds in India? Now, can anybody tell me, do they have a child, or do they know of any children who contact poison ivy dermatitis? Does anybody know? Just put up your hand. I'd just like to see. Yeah. I beg your pardon? Oh, you are, but do you know any children who are? Yes? You have, okay. All right. Well, so I'll have to shut up. It looks as if so. I'll stop.
Come to see him afterwards. I'm going to ask Dr. Julia Levy, who we've heard of tonight, to say a few words of thanks.
Can you take the stuff, please? Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank Neil because we've been associated for a long time, collaborating, and I've never heard you actually put it all together, and I'm sure that everyone here enjoyed it as much as I did, and I'd like to thank you very much indeed, Neil.
We'll see you next week, I hope. Good night.